This is The Difference, a podcast for nonprofit fundraising in a for-profit world, presented by Convergent Nonprofit Solutions, a leader in nonprofit fundraising. Convergent's professionals can help your nonprofit secure sustainable funding now and for the future.
Welcome, I'm Jay Wirth from Convergent. Dennis Frazee and Chris Gullickson join us to discuss supply chain issues and how they affect communities, economic development, and fundraising. Dennis is the CEO of Iowa's Lee Economic Development Group, a two-time campaign client of Convergence. Dennis is a national award-winning marketing professional, public speaker, and facilitator. He co-hosts the number one economic development podcast, Develop This, with listeners in 50 states, over 300 episodes, and 125,000 downloads. Chris Gullickson is the Director of Development and Transportation Policy for the Port of Virginia. Their 50-foot shipping channels connect to the most advanced container terminal in all of the Americas. The Port of Virginia serves as a global gateway to commerce and is a driving economic engine for the states of the Mid-Atlantic. Before joining the port, Chris worked 8 years at the Hampton Roads Economic Development Alliance, another Convergent client. He's very familiar with the priorities and challenges of an economic development organization and the communities they serve.
A long introduction, but I have to add even more. This podcast topic came about because I was conducting a feasibility study for our client in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia and met with one of Chris's colleagues who recommended Chris for this podcast. And I thought there was an interesting perspective that the organization had on the supply chain issues and surrounding topics and how communities and businesses approach that today. So Chris, we'll dig right in. There's a misalignment of inventory and an imbalance in trade, and other areas are creating friction points in the supply chain. That's a big question. Please address it.
Well, Jay, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. Appreciate it. And also, it's a real honor to be part of the podcast with Dennis. You know, many of us in the port community joked no one really cared about what we did for our living until, you know, a year back when the supply chain was definitely in a state of disruption. And at most dinners of big family gatherings, people were saying, you know, so what do you do again? As obviously inventory levels for certain holidays were stretched tight, to say the least. And so, yeah, ultimately, we've gone through a real great period of supply chain disruption. And one of the, you know, I think somewhat of a simple analogy that we always use is the supply chain is only strong as its weakest link, like many teams and many processes. But, you know, what we've definitely seen here now for going, you know, 24 months is that you have, you know, record level volume. So demand is still present, even in times where headlines might reflect differently. We're still here in Virginia seeing volumes at record levels, and that would be container shipping volumes. So we're seeing those record volumes. How do you move that in a fluid, effective manner when there are plenty of links along the chain that are stretched tight? Sitting in the economic development space and thinking about attracting new capital investment, new opportunities to our respective communities, regions, and states, are there the facilities? There are no existing facilities, or are there even sites to build facilities? And so there's obviously, I think, been a renaissance of opportunities in many communities and a flooding of investment coming through COVID and new operations popping up and ribbon cuttings daily. But that all takes time, and the cargo continues to move in and out of our country. And so, you know, as a port, we were very fortunate that coming into COVID, we had a really significant capital improvement program. As the Commonwealth of Virginia invested over about $1 billion in port infrastructure up into about 2019, 2020. Timing at that was really superb. And so when those volumes began to ramp back up through the ports back in the mid-2020, so in the summer times of 2020, we were one of those gateway facilities that had, I would say, available capacity. And granted, that capacity surely has been consumed, and we continue to see record levels. But based on, as you mentioned, being a very advanced, technologically advanced, both from a software sort of operating system perspective, but more importantly, from actually how we move our containers from the vessels, the gates, and into commerce. I think we're doing it obviously at a very advanced manner and really one of the most fluid, non-congested ports. And so being that, you know, really serving as that accelerator, the catalyst to drive opportunities. And so I know, you know, with my economic development partners all throughout the state, being able to meet with companies, if it's both from a BRE perspective and trying to help that company that's struggling, but maybe has a new opportunity to grow their footprint in a respective community, you know, how does the port and our ability to be a constant, stable supporter really make that opportunity come to fruition? And we're seeing that. And that's a great, you know, I think there are plenty of expansion opportunities and wins that we've seen in the past 2 years. And then more importantly, out there talking to companies who are now looking at it differently and looking at that supply chain and conducting those, you know, massive studies to help them identify how do we optimize where our cargo, where our components, where our inputs, you know, whatever it may be, how do we optimize our network so that we don't find ourselves at, you know, deficits and out of stocks like we had seen in the past 2 years through COVID. And so that's been very exciting. And I think those efforts continue to take hold and ports and economic development will continue to be sort of step in step as we hope to serve companies, enable them to optimize supply chains and come up with better decisions and locations.
Well, Chris, you have your port on the Atlantic, and Dennis sits in an office overlooking the Mississippi River in Lee County, Iowa. Dennis, how do you see the challenges there along the river?
Yeah, thanks, Jay and Chris. Awesome to be on with you today. You know, we also have a couple of major rail lines that run through here, and all day containers go through here east and west. And so I'm always blown away by how much stuff is moving all the time. I think a lot of us are struggling. Like, we have a company that uses a lot of balsa wood in their products. And so there was a point where they couldn't get balsa wood from Ecuador. Steel became an issue. And you know, just on a practical level, I went to buy paint the other day and they said, nope. I was trying to match an existing gallon of paint, and they said it's going to be probably 8 weeks. We have a local dirt track that was bringing in some sprint cars. They canceled it last weekend because of a shortage of tires. And so I guess my question for you, Chris, is how did we get here where it seems like, I know we had a disruption, but just from a practical level, where are we at right now, I guess? I mean, I think just from a normal consumer standpoint, and most of our industries, I think, are doing okay because they've had to adapt, right? They've had to figure out other supply chains and those type of things. But I would just be curious on just a primer on how did we get here? I mean, what went wrong or what?
Yeah, and I think you're 100% right. And definitely there are still a number of friction points out there is that you do have warehouses full of product that maybe aren't in the current season where you might want to sell those products. So kind of this anecdotal, but, you know, Christmas holiday wear showing up in February. And so that sits in the warehouse and those retailers still want to sell that product, but it's not going to be for the next until the next season. And now what do you do with all your spring, summer, back to school and Halloween contents? And so ultimately, you know, most of these facilities and warehouses are full. Then it backs up to the yards where the containers will be points of rest. And then it backs up to the terminals. And we, of course, have, I would say, long dwelling containers on occasion. There's containers that come off a ship and the company just cannot pick them up. At the end of the day, we serve the overall supply chain in a much better fashion when there's fluidity, but that freight has to have somewhere to go. And so I do think there's freight out there in the network. It's tires or if it's balsa wood, because I definitely have had those similar conversations. Those materials are just stuck in a way that they either are on vessels that are waiting to come into ports or are in transit. And still waiting to be deconsolidated from that import or container to be then put into a domestic trailer and delivered to that factory.
What do you think is the weakest link?
There are opportunities, I think, to improve upon available warehouse space in most port markets. If someone were to come with what would be typically our, you know, 100,000 or 300,000 square foot warehouse facility requirement, there's not a lot of that product they're having to then do to accommodate that is, you know, obviously maybe take smaller space, have more yard space to just hold content, that fluidity and just in time was working so very well. I mean, I think the easy button is, of course, more distribution facilities close to ports is critical. And I think every port market has seen a real boom. I know here in Virginia, we sure have. And I think that'll continue even through economic cycles here.
Dennis, what Chris describes, is that also true in the heartland or the mid part of the country? You're in Iowa.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we see a shortage of warehouse space as well. I think that's an outgrowth of what's going on. If somebody, to Chris's point, needed 100,000 square foot or 300,000 square foot warehouse, we don't have it. Every building gets snapped up and turned into warehousing right now. And I think that's an outgrowth of companies trying to hedge their bets, if you will, by trying to lay in a little bit extra. But we've got exactly the same problem he's talking about. And just from the economic development standpoint, you know, we're seeing large electric transformers being maybe 2 years out now, you know, and that's a real impact for us. I mean, if you've got someone who wants to expand or has a project and you can't get a transformer for 24 months. So this is really affecting almost every facet of what we do in terms of economic development.
How does national policy on trade impact? And do you think our political leaders understand this issue and are they able to competently address it?
Coming back from, you know, just what, 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago, being there in National Harbor at Select USA, I think Department of Commerce has done a great job of bringing forth international companies that have a desire to be in the U.S. marketplace. But there's always that continued focus on U.S. Opportunities and the desire for those international firms to be participating in the U.S. economy. And so I think that is a great example of a real successful effort led by the Department of Commerce. And also, I would say, you know, here at a port that is very much benefiting from federal funds, if that's from our dredging project, which we're very proud of having that fully funded through our partners there, the Army Corps of Engineer, you know, and that's a project that, you know, it's sort of a 50-50 cost share, or if it's infrastructure monies that we're getting through through MARAD, through Department of Transportation. And we've been very successful in receiving grant funds.
Dennis, your thought?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Chris said makes good sense. I'm glad that there's some positive stuff out there. I mean, both our U.S. senators have been in our county, and I'm sure most of the counties in Iowa, touring facilities, hearing firsthand the struggles, same way as our congressional representative. I think everybody understands the issue and that we need to work together. And we certainly saw that during the beginning of the pandemic when they were able to come together and very quickly push out a massive amount of you know, money and things to help the economy. But it seems to me right now, we're kind of going back to the status quo where everybody comes and they understand the issue. But when we get back to Washington, it doesn't seem like they're able to row in the same direction. Politics rears its ugly head. Now, what doesn't matter what side you're on this, people are hurting everywhere. And this is a real issue. And it's like, it's affecting our communities, both rural and urban.
I hear all of this talk about, gosh, we've got cargo backed up. We can't find warehouse space. Why aren't people building? Is it just a lack of materials? There's not enough profit in holding spaces such as warehouses.
The market will catch up. Some of it is, you know, obviously the deployment of capital towards, you know, certain markets. And I think that has changed, especially you have your primary and secondary and tertiary type markets. And they've all, I think, done very well in attracting monies to spur development and investment. I know from a port perspective, I mean, it is a very, you know, capital intensive effort. And so, you know, when we look at just the billion plus that was spent just towards the end of, you know, 2018, 2019 and 2020, that really has served us well to add capacity. But, you know, we've got another, I would say, you know, close to $1 billion worth of projects underway where we're going to continue to optimize and expand both our on-terminal capacity. But, and Dennis mentioned, you know, seeing the rail, you know, rail is a big part of our business here at the port. In fact, you know, we're one of the largest intermodal rail ports on the East Coast, where about a third of our business is destined for the rail. And that's serving both near market, so those kind of short haul markets, to your Midwest markets like Chicago and Detroit and Columbus and Louisville and Kansas City. All their critical elements. But at the end of the day, it is something that takes significant investments and just the reluctance or the, you know, just the lagging efforts to continue to invest in these critical infrastructure elements. And now that we've had COVID, it really did expose some of those weak points and inability to flex and add additional capacity with what was already maybe a very stretched supply chain network.
Dennis, a project was done recently in Fort Madison to expand access to the Mississippi River.
Yes. Yeah. We had a marina project that's still ongoing. And, you know, I think sometimes when you live in the Mississippi River, you take it for granted because I look out every day and I can see that the barge is going up and down, which is not really part of the marina project. That's a recreational project. But a tremendous amount of grain and other items do get moved up and down the Mississippi. But the flip side of that is we have an aging lock system. And if you're not familiar with locks, the river goes up and down. You know, it's a and sometimes you have to actually go into what's called a lock, and it raises and lowers the barge. But some of those locks are coming up on 80 to 100 years old, and that's going to be another bottleneck in our system. And so we've got all these headwinds, it seems like. And to Chris's point earlier, you can't just magically build warehouses because there's a supply chain issue even on materials to build the warehouses. Plus, we have a worker issue. And so it seems like we have a perfect storm. You know, and like we were talking about earlier, we had this great just-in-time inventory system until we didn't. And so I guess I'd like to know from Chris's perspective, you know, what are the lessons learned here? And I mean, clearly it's going to take some time to flush this through the system and get back to normal, or will we get back to normal at some point?
Yeah, or the cliche new normal, right? Like, you know, as we sit here doing a virtual call, our primary key manufacturers in our respective communities, I think we'll continue to hold more components and more component inventory and have more reserve supply and stock of what they can actually source globally near those respective plants. Because obviously the old way has shown to, you know, falter when there is some stress. I don't know what to be honest, it's hard to like see a crystal ball, but I get to some of the benefits that have gained from all of this is I know that supply chains have gotten more exposure and whereas, you know, sort of transportation and supply chains were just sort of always part of a company and organization. And as long as they were doing their job effectively and getting the products there relatively on time, all is good. And as soon as they weren't, it was pretty apparent how critically important they were. So I know dealing with companies and just people in the community, the supply chain maritime world, obviously there's a lot of renewed interest in trying to attract and obviously a very tight labor market, but, you know, bolstering some of these supply chain and logistics teams at companies and making sure that some of the latest technology and that's something where there has been historically, I would say, somewhat of a lag sometimes on the deployment of technologies. And even if it's simple things as tracking, you know, and having transparency of the supply chain. And I think that's something where, again, companies just sort of always had relied on it happening. At the end of the day, a lot of companies now have really taken a deeper dive. So there's additional transparency and understanding on their network. And that goes back to then evaluating if our facility is here, does this really best serve us as an organization? And then those are neat discussions that are happening and ones that we participate in and have a value proposition to provide an alternative and to kind of allow for those businesses and companies to sort of reevaluate and reconsider how they've structured their supply chain network.
As we close this podcast, I'm interested, Dennis, in hearing your thoughts about what you're hearing from economic developers around the country, and maybe to the point, are economic development organizations and chambers of commerce nimble and innovative to the point where they can address these challenges in creative ways?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jay. I mean, I think, yes, the answer is to say that I believe economic development organizations and chambers, we've had to be nimble over the past couple of years, just like everyone else. I mean, it's like, if you haven't been nimble, then you're probably in big trouble. You probably won't be in the same organization in a couple of years because no one's going to fund you, frankly. You know, I think there's a frustration on the local level because there's so many of these things As Chris described, you know, we don't have any control over what's happening in the ports or the import exports. And so all we can do is support our companies. And certainly, I think that comes to us at the workforce level. That's where we can really dig in. And by
for more resources to assist with your fundraising and access to this podcast series, go to convergentnonprofit.com. At the homepage, look for the resources tab. I'm Gene Wirth for Convergent Nonprofit Solutions. Thanks for listening.
How do we get that message out there and keep, I think we need a collective voice out there. And I think that's one thing IDC does a good job of, is trying to collectively get our voices together, because it's much stronger if we speak as an industry versus, you know, a guy in Iowa, in rural Iowa, saying, hey, we're having trouble. Well, yeah, sure. So I think that's our challenge. I do think economic development organizations have stepped up in a lot of creative ways. We appreciate the work people like Chris are doing. And so, Chris, if you don't mind me asking a quick question as we wrap up here. I know nothing about ports, but can you give us some snapshot of volume? What does that look like for you guys? I mean, we talk about containers and things like that, but can you share just a quick, like, what is that in your world?
Like any business, we have funny acronyms, and the common measurement metric that ports use to measure their volume for container ports is, it's not so much like the tonnage, but it's really the units. And so we refer to them as TEUs, and that's 20-foot equivalent units. We just closed our fiscal year on June 30th for FY22, and we moved 3.7 million TEUs over a prior year in 2021. Fiscal year 2021, we had moved 3.5 million TEUs. So obviously healthy growth. You know, in an average week right now, we're moving at the docks. We have about 50,000 lifts, which is significant and very impressive. Of that 3.7 million TEUs, about two thirds of that goes out the gate on the back of a truck. And we run a 6 day a week operation. One of our facilities open at 2 o'clock and one we open at 5. And our last gate is at, 5 o'clock, full days here. And it's constant. It's one that it daily provides challenges. But again, with having technology and having appointment systems in place to allow for us to be a more predictive terminal, I think has been truly a benefit in making sure those, 3.7 million containers that we're handling are being done in such a way that it's fluid and being of value.
We appreciate the insights of Chris Gullickson, Director of Development and Transportation Policy for the Port of Virginia, and Dennis Frazee, CEO of Iowa's Lee Economic Development Group. For resources to help your fundraising and to listen to episodes of this podcast, go to convergentnonprofit.com. Click on the resources link on the homepage. I'm Jay Wirth for The Difference. Thanks for listening.